Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. This week, how D. Razzali created one of London's most original and loved bakeries.
I develop recipes because other people need to use them. I don't use recipes. I use my hands often as weights because I know, I just can feel it. And it's like anything, more than an artist, it's about craft. And you need to be able to feel what you do. So when I put my hand in dough, I can tell if it's good or bad.
Then we get some inspiration for cocktails as I speak to Tim Warrilow, co-founder of Fever Tree.
There are all of these fantastic new spirits that have come to the market, as well as people discovering the old classic spirits. And so the variety is huge, which in truth is why we are seeing this world of spirits and mixed drinks and cocktails growing and growing around the world.
And of course, we'll hear a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. When it comes to bakeries in London, Fortitude Bakehouse is unique in what it does, focusing on natural flavors, fermentation and sourdough cakes and bakes. There are no cakes loaded with sugar or artificial flavors here, and that's a part of the magic that has given the bakery a cult following from across the UK and beyond. D. Razzali runs the bakery, and already before it was launched, she had the reputation for pioneering the organic food movement in the UK. Now D. has finally released her debut cookbook, Baking with Fortitude, and she joined me in the studio to talk about her cooking principles, how the way she bakes has evolved, and the importance of instincts when baking. First, she described the way she works.
I always see it as craft baking, because it's about, with craft, people take a, it's like having a piece of wool, and some crafters don't need a pattern or don't, like I don't need a recipe. I develop recipes because other people need to use them. But if you ask anybody that bakes with me on a daily basis, I don't use recipes. I use my hands often as weights, or I'll use the scales, but I'll make it up as I go along, or a recipe that I've already developed. I very rarely weigh it because I know, I just can feel it. And it's like anything that's, more than an artist, it's about craft. And you need to be able to feel what you do. So when I put my hand in dough, I can tell if it's good or bad. And that comes from doing this since I was a child. We started in Ireland, we baked very simply because you didn't have the ingredients. You didn't have, you know, all year round. We didn't have bananas. I can't remember the first time I ate a banana. I wasn't that young. But we had lots of things, like we could get citrus fruit, but only in January, or we used lots of spices. We had lots of dried fruit, things that would sit in the cupboard. And you had to be inventive. And that's where it started. And I started when I was about 8 or 9, baking, because that became my job in the household. So it's very crafty. I don't want things to look perfect on purpose. I'm not going to spend hours of my time trying to make things look perfect, because for me, that's not the reality of life. And it fits my personality that we can, everybody should be able to share in what we do. People should be able to come in, and it's a welcoming product rather than coming in and going, wow, I don't know whether to eat it or look at it or photograph it. For me, it's about food and provenance and accessibility, really, for people. But it is also about a craft.
How has the style of your baking evolved? Because obviously people know you for your sourdough starters and fermenting your batters, for example, before baking. That style, did you have that already in Ireland, or is it something you've learned along the way over the years?
It's something I've developed because you have to be able to know how to use ingredients. That's a big thing. There's such waste in the world. In pastry kitchens, often, if they're more advanced commercial pastry kitchens, products aren't real for me. They're like sugars and glucose and colours, and which is fine, and everything's got its place in the world. I'm not, you know, dismissing anyone. But for me personally, it had to be about nature. And with nature, waste, you can't waste product. You can't waste butter. You can't waste milk. It's such a sin to do that. For me personally, I feel that. So I had to find ways of using products and giving them longevity. So with butter, if somebody said to me, it's got a sell-by date, I think, so what? Butter is a product that if you add salt to it, you can give it a longer life, or you can just have it sitting there and it has a bit of a bubble and it has a particular smell, but it's not going to kill you because it's pasteurized. And so that's how I see things. It's like if people see, oh, there's a little bit of mold. Now, I don't use that in my kitchen, but when I experiment, I'll put things away for 3 or 4 weeks and I check them and I look at mold and I look at... It's like a science experiment.
Does it always work?
No. It doesn't. But it's for me, I've been doing this so long, I needed to find an outlet which gave me inspiration too. So I use what I know. I'm not of the ilk that's going to go down the road of trying to reinvent the wheel in patisserie. I wanted to do something which was about making the world a better place to be. Now, that sounds crazy because a lot of people, I'm sure, would just think it's just cake. But I think we need to learn methods of preserving food in our lifetime because we can't continue. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a political person. I just believe in what I do. And I saw my grandparents work in exactly the same way as I do now and have incredible longevity in their life. Both of them were in their 90s when they died. And very healthy, other than the sort of old age things that happen to people. And they live like I kind of live now. I mean, I obviously have a bit more va-va-voom to my life because I'm in London and I can fly around the world if I want to, pre-pandemic. But yeah, that's kind of, it was just a style that I've developed all of my own. There isn't really anybody out there that's doing now what I do. There will be, because it's exactly what happened with Patisserie Organic. When I set up Patisserie Organic in 1998, people were not that interested in organic food. They weren't interested in permaculture. They weren't interested in biodynamics. And I just thought, well, I am. So I'm just going to do it. I don't need to follow anybody. And I was quite young, probably quite naive, because, you know, it was a huge financial burden on me at the time. But I just did it and it's continued. It's just continued as one big experiment. But one of the reasons I do it, I really got into it in a commercial way. When I say commercial way, it's baking for other people en masse, was because I was working with a company called Fernandez and Wells, which was based in central London. And George Fernandez, who is my partner now, he at the time was looking for somebody who could bake and give his product provenance and sit beside his idea of what coffee should be like or what products should be like, and that not to overtake the taste of the coffee. And they were sort of this new way of coffee. He was at the beginning of that. He was really the beginning of that. And so we had this kind of working relationship where I would have to find products that he wasn't throwing away at the end of the day, because so many places just put everything in the bin. My products had a 7 to 10 day shelf life, not through any kind of artificial method, but through crafting and fermentation. That was about 12 years ago. Now, they were the first people in London that I really worked with. And then other people started to look at it and go, OK, wow, I need to save. Because a lot of these small independents were about saving money, but also about saving wastage within a company. It was a massive problem in coffee shops because everybody was selling croissants and they last a day. And so they were like just putting them in the bin. I could see it everywhere. And that's really why I developed it then commercially, to make a business out of it.
And now you have released your book, Baking with Fortitude. I'm wondering, the idea to release a book like this, was it something you thought about during the pandemic? Was that the right time to start writing a book? Or did you have a mission? Do you want to spread the word of this kind of baking to make things a bit more environmentally conscious in that front?
I'd been asked previously about 15 years ago to do it. And I'm a very private person, in some ways quite introverted, I think, what I do, because it's, you get up at 4 a.m. and you work often on your own. And sometimes I'm the last person to leave. It makes you a little bit introverted. So I wanted people to understand what I was doing at Fortitude, because not everybody gets it. I don't expect everybody to get it. The way I see it, I've been baking for 30 years of my life professionally. And I can see everybody makes croissant and everybody makes sourdough bread, and it's become a real hipster haven, and that's wonderful, and you know, the kids love it and all that, and it's great. It's great that it carries on a baking tradition in London in particular, because that's where I've always been based. But I thought, well, I don't want to make croissant. Everybody's doing the same thing. The way I've always baked and cooked has been quite maverick, I think, but I've never wanted to put myself out there. So you can be as maverick as you want in the background, but actually if you have something to say, you need to put yourself out there. Bloomsbury had approached me a year before the pandemic, and I decided to do it because I thought, OK, I really like this product. People were getting to know about it and understand the fact that what I was about more than, you know, I had to put myself out there somehow because I believe in what I do. And I also believe in the fact that doing craft of any kind is really, really good for your mental health. And I've worked for years with people with mental health issues and people from refugee backgrounds, or just people who want to do something and they get a bit stuck in their life and they come to me and I'll say, okay, I'll train you. And I've done that. I never, or maybe once in 10 years, have taken on a trained baker. And I thought, if I'm going to be doing this stuff, I want other people to know that they can do it too.
So it's about spreading word.
It is,
at
really.
Same time.
Yeah. Without it being a big political issue, even though it kind of is in some ways, from my point of view, it's a very simple process that we can all enjoy if you want to enjoy it.
Mm. And this is one of my favourite books of 2021. I'm wondering,
you said
you are a very private person. I'm wondering how nerve-wracking was it to release this book?
It was
it
was very. I've had some. When people, I had a really, really lovely email from a lady in Stockholm on Saturday, and she put this on her story. She's an interior designer, and often people, it's more crafty people that get what I'm doing, and they like the colour and the variation and the herbs. And she said, I've made your lemon and Earl Grey cake, and it's the best cake I've ever eaten. And I thought, my initial, you know, you take a breath when you see it. And I think it has caused me great anxiety because I want people to like it, because I think it's an important book in that it's accessible to everybody, but it's also got something really powerful to say in terms of provenance and flavours, and that you can use everything from a hedgerow to from a tree, from a flower. It doesn't have to all be about fads or, you know, this is a book for a lifetime, I think, rather than just something that next year I'll be writing the same thing, because I won't. So, yeah, it's caused me some anxiety, I have to say.
You've been an influential figure in London's food and baking world since the 1990s. It's been said that you were one of the first people to bring biodynamic organic foods to London. Is it also true that you've baked for the likes of Prince Charles and Madonna, for example?
I did. Through my original business, Patisserie Organic, I set up a kind of events company that went beside it. So I did lots of the events for, I did Ken Livingstone's inauguration. We did the Green Party. We would do the Body Shop, which was huge at the time. And then it kind of, the word spread. And I did some work with the Prince's Trust. And I took on two young people. They were interested in baking, so I took them on for a little while. And then Prince Charles asked for a cake to be made for one of his birthdays. Mm-hmm. So I did that. It was very nice to do it. I did one for Damon from Blur. Madonna wanted something that was wheat-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, everything-free. So we had to come up with a cake that tasted edible. We've done lots of stuff that for really interesting people. We were a little bit quirky, so we would do a lot of Greenpeace events. We made a huge half globe for them with people kind of running all over it with organic ingredients. And we had to make colour because obviously they didn't want artificial colour. So we've done lots of interesting, quirky things. They weren't so high profile. I chose, they were private things at the time. And I thought it's just an honour to be asked to do them. Mm. And they spoke about them after rather than me speaking about them. So it was really nice that they enjoyed them.
Well, now the book is out, I'm wondering what kind of plans do you have for the future in terms of what's happening at Fortitude Bakehouse?
At the moment, we're trying to rebuild ourselves in terms of our list of wholesale customers who are still struggling to get back on their feet. Some of them are doing well, some of them have either closed or that are trying to come back round, and we try and support them as much as possible. We are looking at a bigger site in the East End of London, and we're in talks about that at the moment. I think we would like to do is to be able to offer more of my cooking side. So it might be cooking with Fortitude next year that we're doing, but to offer a little bit more of the same theory and practice, but in the savoury side. But you need space to do that. So that's what we're looking at. And we're starting up. People are coming back. They're doing events, and we're developing that side of the business now more because it's a very productive thing to do. What I have learned through the pandemic, it's quite nice to have quality of life, because as a baker, we don't often have the quality of life that we could or should have.
So you don't always need to wake up at 3 o'clock?
Yeah, I think I've learned to kind of give over some of my control freakness to people, other people, where they can do it rather than me having to do it.
One more question. I'm wondering, looking at this book, what is your favourite recipe? What should our listeners try first?
I like our brioche recipe. It's because people always say to me, oh, I'd love to make brioche, but I can't because it's got all these stages. With my brioche, it doesn't have any stages. You just make it in a bowl and put it in the fridge. And the next day, it's a phenomenal thing to use. So that's my favourite.
Dear Atali of London's Fortitude Bakehouse there, and her debut book, Baking with Fortitude, is out now. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monaco's Carla Tarabello.
Thanks, Marcus. The latest development in the ongoing spat between Russia and France over the use of the translation of champagne has seen Russia delay the labor law by 2 months. France guards the use of the term champagne and has been in talks with Moscow about the law signed by President Vladimir Putin in July, which would stop French imports being able to use the Russian translation. It remains to be seen whether Russia, the 15th biggest export market for French champagne, has the bottle to make the move. In other drink news, the non-alcoholic industry continues to be on the up as Los Angeles welcomes its first shop dedicated to boozeless beverages. Soft Spirits on Sunset Boulevard has a range of recreational drinks, including spiritless spirit brands, as well as mood-enhancing functional drinks, making it a one-stop shop for both the sober and the growing community of sober curious. Elsewhere in the US, permanent outdoor dining plans in New York City have taken a major step forward. An amendment on relaxing zoning laws in the city could allow more restaurants the ability to set up dining patios. The plan is now in the hands of the City Council, who will vote on the measure after a public hearing. Despite some opposition over noise levels and sanitary conditions, it has the potential to be a huge help to the thousands of restaurants still struggling as a result of the pandemic. And finally, in the UK, crisps remain in short supply in almost 1 in 3 British shops. Problems with supply chains have been exacerbated by Brexit and made even worse after Britain's biggest crisp producer, Walkers, had to scale back production after an IT systems issue at the start of the month. With shortages expected for several more weeks, crisp lovers will be feeling the crunch. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Carlotta. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. Fever Tree has grown and become one of the world's most popular premium mixer brands with its range of tonics, sodas, ginger beers, lemonades, and much more. It's an impressive achievement considering that it was launched only in 2005. Now the company's products are for sale in over 80 countries, and as you may well guess, the sales of the products have boomed during the pandemic when people have been spending more time at home. Now the company has released its own cocktail guide. Fever Tree Easy Mixing promises to have over 150 quick and delicious recipes. To talk about the new book, the boom in home mixing, and the success story of Fever Tree, I was joined in the studio by the company's co-founder, Tim Warrilow.
The idea came about from a sort of meeting of minds in the fact that I started the business, my business partner, Charles Rolls. And I was looking at the time at opportunities in around premium drinks and very specifically gin. Charles had made quite a name and reputation for himself of resurrecting this wonderful old brand of gin called Plymouth Gin and putting it very successfully back on the market, and had sold the business to one of the big drinks spirit companies. And so when I was doing my research into gin, a couple of people I spoke to said, you should contact this chap, Charles. And so I did. We met for a cup of coffee to talk about gin. But over that very first cup of coffee, the conversation turned sort of very quickly from gin to tonic and to mixers more widely. And that's because we're both from different experiences, had really had the same thought and sort of identified the same gap in the market. And that was that, you know, at the time, this is taking us back a bit now. This is sort of 2003 when we had that first cup of coffee. The spirits industry around the world is really starting to develop, and very particularly the premium end of the spirits industry. All the big spirit companies were turning their time and attention to their sort of premium portfolio. They're starting to talk about more about provenance and about distilling techniques and about ingredients. And craft spirits were just starting to come to the fore. Tax laws had changed around the world, which meant that these small distilleries were opening up. And at the same time, you know, the bar trade, cocktail bars were starting to reemerge and really make a name for themselves. And the mixologists and bartenders behind them were starting to become talked about and covered in the press. So there was all of this interest and noise going on in the world of spirits. Yet, in stark contrast, the mixer category had remained the preserve of a couple of large global brands. We thought this was extraordinary, you know, bearing in mind all of these spirits were being mixed with, you know, this limited range of mixers, particularly when you think that there were people prepared and interested and wanting and willing to spend more money on these good quality spirits. So that was the thought. We thought, surely if we could produce, you know, a fantastic range, we could make people realise that that mixer was as important as the spirit is being mixed with.
It's been such a success story. And actually, I should direct our listeners to listen to the entrepreneurs from last year, because my colleague Daniel Bate interviewed you for that programme and profiled the business very nicely. But let's continue to this day. You have just released a new book, Fever Tree, Easy Mixing, More Than 150 Quick and Delicious Mixed Drinks and Cocktails. And I do understand that the release of this book may have something to do with the pandemic and the lockdowns.
Absolutely. In fact, a very direct result of the pandemic and lockdowns. And that was because, of course, sadly, the hotel, bar, restaurant market was closed down. And so people turned to making drinks at home in sort of greater numbers than ever before. And not just here in the UK, but all around the world. And not only that, is that that sort of evening drink became people's treat and entertainment. And so we found ourselves as a business being inundated with people asking us about, you know, what tonic they can mix with what gin, what can they mix with bourbon, how does tequila, you know, go in various drinks. So we were just there fielding all of these questions about how to make these drinks. And so we thought, well, we should make a book of it.
Now then, looking at this book, how do you decide which 150 recipes to include? And what to leave out? Well, what was the guiding principle in deciding what to include in this release?
Well, it is a good question, because you know, this is the exciting thing that's happened in the world of spirits over the last 10, 15 years, is there all of these fantastic new spirits that have come to the market, as well as people discovering the old classic spirits. And so the variety is huge, which in truth is why, you know, we are seeing this world of spirits and mixed drinks and cocktails growing and growing around the world. You know, interestingly, you know, beer is broadly speaking in decline. Wine is stagnating. But, you know, there's all of this interest and growth in the world of spirits. And so, as you rightly say, it actually was a case of what do we leave out, you know, rather than we put in. So we tried to distill it down to 5-6 different sections in the book and concentrate on gin and tonics, concentrate on mules, concentrate on highballs, some I think we called one sort of odds and sods, low and no alcohol, and then crucially also pitchers, you know, how to make these drinks for a party occasion.
Do you want to tell us about your favourite recipes? I'm actually also looking at what you brought with you, so I gather that we are about to actually make one of your favourite drinks over here in the studio.
Well, I always come armed, you know, with a cocktail wherever I travel. And, you know, hence my bag as I walked in was dripping because it was the ice was, you know, melting as I've just got off my scooter to come here. So I've got that. So yes, you know, well, favourite drinks, it's very hard, you know, to choose a favourite drink, particularly out of these 150. It is, I think, as the expression goes, like choosing your favourite son. But I have brought with me a tequila and a Mexican lime soda. So this is a new range that we actually launched during lockdown, our flavoured sodas. We launched with a bit of anxiety because usually we would be putting it in the hotels and bars and getting people to try it that way, and we had sort of grand plans. But of course that was taken away from us. So we put it on supermarket shelves. But you know, excitingly, people discovered it. And we've had so many sort of comments in about it that I thought this was an opportune one to bring with me to show you. And so, look, shall I make it as we go?
Sounds good.
And try and talk you through it. So, you know, the one thing that we find in terms of the advice we dispense is consistent, regardless of the mixed drink, is ice. You've got to use as much ice as you possibly can, because, you know, there's nothing that kills a drink more than the fact that it goes warm quickly, but also dilutes too quickly. So it's the one thing that people don't quite appreciate, I think, is the more ice you put in, the colder the drink, the less it's likely to dilute.
So what's the right amount of ice?
Well, it really is sort of 3/4 of a glass. And the other crucial thing about keeping a drink cold is it keeps the carbonation in the drink. The other thing that kills a mixed drink is it going flat. And that is usually a direct result of people not making it cold enough. And carbonation is crucial because apart from the fact it delivers all those wonderful flavours around the drink, it also sort of spritzes up so you get it in the nose before you've even started. So it's fundamental to it. And I can't tell you the trouble we go to put lots of carbonation in. So ice, crucial. So I've filled it up with lots of ice. And now I'm giving you a good, healthy slug of tequila. And the interesting thing is when you talk to people about tequila in the UK, you know, quite often they kind of recoil and they start, you know, remembering
The hangovers,
the shots, you know, when they're in their sort of late teens. But this is a spirit that is in amazing growth around the world, tequila, and nowhere more so than in the US, where it's growing and growing. And all the sort of Hollywood celebrities have started to, you know, develop their own tequila brands, from George Clooney to The Rock. And for the reason, it is a fantastic spirit. And delicious spirit as a base in a drink. So here we are. So here's some tequila. And then, of course, you know, the crucial ingredient is our Mexican lime soda, which is made with these wonderful Mexican limes and also a bit of yuzu, which is a Japanese lime. And actually, you know, these are limes that I went out and found out in Mexico, in the Yucatan province in Mexico. And the thing about the Yucatan province is it's an extraordinary part of Mexico where it's incredibly rocky. And that's because that is where the meteorite hit, which is when the dinosaurs are wiped out. But the result being is the impact was so great that actually it drove all the water underground and all the rocks came to the fore. So you would have thought that's the most unlikely place to be able to grow citrus, but the climate is perfect. And as a result, the citrus that is there has to work incredibly hard to go and find its water source. So as a result, the fruit that it produces is incredibly intense, and as a result, the most desired in the world. So that's where we get our Mexican limes from. And you just simply add that to the wonderful tequila. And then if you're really wanting to sort of, you know, show off with your garnish, I've got here a cucumber, so some ribbons of cucumber and also a bit of chili. And there we are. This is our Texas ranch water, Marcus. So you've got to give me your opinion on that.
Cheers. It's very nice, of course, and I have to say I do like my tequila every now and then, less so in the short form recently.
Yeah, well, I quite agree, and that is the point, is that it is this delicious base to a drink, and so that's why, you know, when it's mixed well, I think it's fantastic.
Tim Warrilow, co-founder of Fever Tree there, and the new book Fever Tree Easy Mixing is out now. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our menu spin-off show Food Neighbourhoods for great recipes. This show is co-produced by Charlie Phil McCourt and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and edited and mixed by Czech Chewers. I am Marcus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. This week we hear from Tresor da Capo and Sun Il Musician. This is Lighthouse. Thanks for listening.